Golden Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now, Ain't I a Woman? Shirley Long and Margaret Lee discuss the grueling 24-hour shifts of home health aides taking care of seriously ill elders and people with disabilities with round-the-clock needs.
Needs that take a toll on workers' health and their family relationships, and how that can affect the care itself.
And then there's the insurance companies who benefit from the 24-hour workdays, paying the workers for only 13 hours.
We're joined by Professor Shirley Lung at CUNY School of Law, former director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights, and author of Criminalizing Work and Non-Work, The Disciplining of Immigrant and African-American Workers, and Margaret Lee, organizer with the Anti-Woman Campaign.
Now, whatever happened to the 8-hour day? The issue of 24-hour shifts in one of the America's most progressive states, New York, 24-hour shifts for people as home health aides. All I can think about is both the necessity for people who are disabled, who are elderly, who are sick, who may need 24-hour service, but not from one continuous shift person. So I keep thinking about, my God, what's ever happened to the 8-hour day, and why are we still fighting for that? And maybe you can start off with it, Margaret, and perhaps your own experience with your mom, who I understand was a home healthcare worker.
Yeah, my mother was a home healthcare worker before she became an RN. I believe worked 12-hour shifts. That was something that she was told she had to do. She did that for a few years while she studied and went to community college to become an RN. But then when she did become an RN, there were times, I think as she started, she worked an 8-hour shift and she was part of 1199. And then she would always come home and talk about the discussions that the nurses were having with the union and then and management. And eventually she started working 12-hour shifts. And she was like, it's fine. We don't work them back to back. But then like, on occasion, she would work back-to-back shifts, which would be 24, if, say, a coworker called in sick and there was no one to cover. However, she would get paid double time. So she kind of felt okay about working that double shift, knowing that it was a very extraordinary case, that she wasn't going to be required to work 24 hours, and that wasn't going to become normal, and that when she did work a shift like that, she was going to be paid double time for the second shift. So when I heard about what was going on with the home attendants now in New York State, I was really shocked because it's such a different experience than my own mother had in the same industry.
And you've done a lot of work on this, Shirley, and you've done work for organizations like the one that Margaret Lee works with, the Ain't I a Woman campaign and so on. So give us a sense of the breadth and the depth of this issue of home attendant working in New York City for 20-hour, 4-hour shifts.
I mean, I think that the issue that home care workers are facing in New York is reflective of a larger structural issue in terms of working conditions. It's probably surprising to most people that we don't have a right to protest or to refuse to work 24 hours a day if that's what our employers require of us, that we don't have a legal right to basically know to say to excessive hours that are either hurting our own health or the health of the people, the home attendants who are caretaking, that there's no legal right to refuse excessive hours that basically really hurt people's abilities to spend time with their families, to raise their kids, and also compromise their own health and damage their own health, that we don't, like across the board, we don't have that right, and you don't have that right unless you are protected from having that right based on some kind of union contract, but there are no union contracts protecting the right to have bans against working 24 hours. So it's a larger structural issue about workers being able to have control over their time. And what we see with the home care attendants is that's what our system enables, empowers employers to be able to do that. And when you think of it, like people will say, this is shocking that people, home care attendants, would have to give in to the demand of their employers to work 24-hour shifts because that's how the employers find it useful for them to structure the hours is not best for the workers who are doing this work of caring for people, and it isn't the best for people who are being cared for, who are people who get 24-hour authorization for 24-hour care are the people who have the greatest health and or physical health conditions, right? So it's a larger issue of hours and ability, the ability of workers to have control over the hours. And we see this as a reflection of that larger issue because we do also see the creep in hours and the lack of control of hours among many workers in many kinds of occupations, not just workers who are in home care. It's not just workers who are working in restaurants or in construction, but it's also workers who are working in professional jobs, right? And so it's really reflective of a larger important issue that's important to all people who are workers in terms of the fact that the legal system that we live in does empowers employers to demand workers to work 24 hours, and if you refuse to, you could be fired, or if you refuse to, you can be retaliated by not being given any more work.
Surely, as I understand it, there's no additional pay for anything over 13 hours. So I know you've been working on a legislative fix for this. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, the fix. So in New York, the current is that it's legal to pay for 13 hours of a 24-hour shift if work. At a certain amount of uninterrupted sleep and uninterrupted meal breaks, which if you listen to home care workers, that doesn't happen. You don't get uninterrupted sleep. You don't get uninterrupted breaks because the people who you're providing care for and that you want to provide the best care possible are the people who have the most needs. That's why they've been authorized for 24-hour care. So it's totally a legal fiction that you're getting uninterrupted sleep and uninterrupted breaks. Pay, which also exacerbates this idea that the 24-hour workday, that you're legal to pay for 13, 24 hours based on the legal fiction lie, right? It's a fiction that you have uninterrupted sleep, that you have uninterrupted meal breaks, that the time is somehow is yours. The time is not yours because you have to be on the lookout. You have to be ready at any moment to come to someone's aid, to make sure that they are getting the care they need. So the issue of pay is one issue. Even if we paid people for every hour that's worked, I think it's just like, what does it say about our society that we're willing to give employers the power to mandate people to work 24 hours a day and to do multiple shifts of 24 hours a day? Is it something that people choose to do? Could it be possible that people really choose to do that, that people have the choice to do that? And that's another untruth that people use to justify workers being forced to work 24-hour days.
When we say workers, what kind of workers? Who are we really talking about? I know that there are at least 240,000 workers in New York City who are home attendants, the majority of whom are immigrant women of color. Right. And about 8% of those work 24-hour shifts. And I think it has everything to do with the idea of being able, the insurance companies essentially, to pay 13 hours of round-the-clock work for 24 hours. What is the kind of work these folks do to give a real sense of who they are and how hard the jobs are and what it means to put people through a 24-hour regimen? Margaret?
We should be clear in stating that most of the home care attendants we do organize with who work 24-hour shifts have said even if they were paid for every hour of that 24-hour day, they would still want to refuse a 24-hour shift, especially because they're often back-to-back. So they're being, you know, kept from their families for days on end. But the care, obviously, those needing round-the-clock care have great needs. Anything from administering medicine, turning people over so they don't get bed sores, cleaning, cooking even, you know, housework, and taking care of their workplace while taking care of the patients as well. And, you know, as an individual having to move a body that's unable to move on its own, you can imagine what that does to your own health. And, you know, a lot of the health home attendants become patients themselves. They become disabled from the years of this type of backbreaking work. You know, like in my mother's experience, of course she would come home tired from like working in the hospital, but she had help, you know. She wasn't the only person, you know, in charge of one patient. And even that work, you know, and the 12-hour shift was very physically demanding.
Yeah, it's physically demanding because of turning people over so that they don't get bed sores, of helping people to go to the restroom, being awake and aware to see if someone needs something, if they're calling for your help or if they're getting out of bed and could be hurting themselves because they're not physically, like it's difficult for them to be physically mobile. And so it's all of that, and it's all of those stresses. And doing that kind of work, if you're doing it 24 hours a day and you're doing that years on end, you know, that has an impact on your ability to sleep, on your rhythms, you know, like sort of your sleep-wake cycle rhythms, your ability to eat, to digest, the stress that that causes. It takes great and as Margaret is saying, that many of the home care workers who have come in contact and work with Anti-Women Campaign and other independent worker centers talk about that toll that it takes on them physically. And then also the fact that they're working 24 hours. They have children. They have families, right? And so what's happening to their families, especially when they're having children, when they have children, young children, teenagers, what's happening to their families while they're constantly working these 24-hour shifts? So the tolls are everything that range from just how people are affected in their own health and well-being to also their own families and well-being of being able to have time for their own children as well and their family members. It is.
Right, and also, you know, the emotional toll of caring for patients who need care. You know, you don't want to think that you didn't provide the services that the patient needed. You
yeah.
know, it's like we're human. We want to know that our labor is leading to others, you know, staying healthy. You don't want to be mentioned on your job. And a lot of the home attendants have reported saying that when they complained about not being paid for those, you know, hours after the 13th, their agencies tell them, well, you're supposed to sleep. So go to sleep and ignore your patient during those hours.
But how can they ignore their patients during
exactly.
that hour? That would be an abandonment of their responsibilities. And so
right.
the system is really exploiting women workers who are working as home care workers. And as you say, Mimi, it's largely immigrant women and women of color, right? And so the work is not valued, the women are not valued, and so we have the system that workers, home care workers, are subject to working 24 hours. And also the other thing is sometimes the people who are being cared for, they may have mental health issues that they're dealing with that also make it challenging to care for someone who may have Alzheimer's or who has other kinds of mental health conditions. And so that's also part of the job. And if we even just look at the pandemic, how the pandemic has had this disproportionate negative impact on home care workers who are really concerned not to contract the virus, not to give it to their patients, can, but not always, even not being provided with the equipment by their home care agencies to be able to keep themselves and the people they care for safe, just shows you that the system that's in place doesn't give regard the women who are largely women who are doing this really important work.
And just take it a step further. These are only one very extreme example, but there are many workers, especially immigrant workers in other parts of the economy, especially restaurant workers and construction workers, who are also working for low wages and long hours. En masse, an anti-women person, legislative fixes on this last year, but Governor Cuomo refused to go along with the state legislature. Tell us more about how extensive the problem is of long hours and low wages and what can be done about it.
And, of course, en masse is the national mobilization against sweatshops.
You're right. The issue of long hours and low wages is endemic to workers in all kinds of industries, as the ones you mentioned, and it's across race and ethnic communities. And it's the idea and the issue of immigration status always also comes into it. And there are many kinds of things that employers can use also to pit and divide workers against each other, to make workers fear coming out to protest the abuses, or and even when workers do, that they're also met with a legal system that doesn't support their ability to assert their rights and to make employers pay what is due. And that was the reason behind the sweat bill that was passed by both New York State Senate and Assembly, but vetoed by governor, which would give workers the ability to try to obtain wages that have been lawfully by imposing liability, the ability to try to get these wages, attaching or placing liens on property of law-breaking employers who are stealing workers' rightful wages. And then the issue of low wages, like in New York State, right, the minimum wage in most parts of the state now is $15, but there's rampant violation of the minimum wage, rampant violation for the payment of overtime, because employers know that they are in a legal system that doesn't give a lot of workers legal tools to deter this kind of behavior. And if employers feel that they can't get away with the behavior, they will use these exploitative practices of not paying wages at all, withholding wages, or paying far below the minimum wage, or not paying overtime.
I remember going back to the Wages for Housework movement, which was a grassroots women's network in the 1970s that fought for recognition and payment for all care work. Certainly the Ain't I a Woman campaign evolved in many ways from that campaign. I wonder if you can talk about the evolution of the work that you two have done in a grassroots setting of the Ain't I a Woman campaign and through legislatures and lawsuits where Shirley's research and scholarship has complemented the efforts. Take us through that, as we are in Women's History Month and there's such an enormous role that groups like Ain't I a Woman have put into a workers' issue and a feminist issue and an issue about immigrants and women of color, all melded together for equal rights, equal pay, and certainly, wow, let's go back to the 8-hour day. Trace some of the organizing efforts that we've gone through, if you would.
One thing that's amazing about the Ain't I a Woman campaign is that it's woman-led. And when we talk about labor issues often, you know, we still run up against people who are, when you bring up labor issues or workers' rights, they still think of the factory. And while Ain't I a Woman started with sweatshop workers, as sweatshops were closing down in New York and moving out of the country for financial reasons, the workers started feeling like the workplace of the sweatshop was just transferred from one shop and then dispersed into like a new industry, which was the service industry, puts us to care work. So people have to make this jump. Like even today, we can talk to people who are labor activists and they still seem to sort of marginalize our fight because maybe they don't see care work being on the same level playing field as like an auto body, like a car shop, the old school factory. And, you know, that has a lot to do, I think, with the bias against women's work traditionally. And so the Ain't I a Woman campaign is really exciting because you have essentially women at the front lines of reinvigorating labor's lost fight, which is the fight for time. You know, a lot of times we talk about why is this happening? It's because organized labor sort of gave up on fighting for time, fought for wages. They kind of forgot about control over our time and lives. They kind of forgot about the 8-hour day. If you work overtime, we'll fight for that overtime pay instead of fighting to maintain the system of the 40-hour work week that so many people fought and died for.
It's the idea that for so long, since the labor struggles and strikes, right, that occurred in the 19th century, though demanding wasn't just about economic demands, it was about a political demand to control the workday, to control the hours of the workday, that you have a right to a work outside of the 8 hours that you had over what your workday would be, the length of it. And so that labor abandoned that political demand, and increasingly the demands became economic. What's so powerful about the anti-women campaign is that it's trying to talk about that rights, about workers' rights. It's not only about economic demands, but it's about the political demands of a right to control the hours we work, to define the workday, right? In the case of women who are asserting their right, and women who are doing this kind of work that's not valued by society, because it's not, people like see it, belittle it, is not work, yet recognize work that's so important to our society, but yet then at another level, a lot of that arises from the history of slavery, of thinking of labor of Black women, just about, so it's all tied in terms of the institution of slavery, of how work is defined, whose work matters, what's work, and to the present day legal system, how we define this work. I agree with Margaret is that it's elevating this concern that this is a demand, a political demand. It's not just an economic demand, political demand that can unite many working people no matter what occupation they are, because we are all experiencing that, right? When people talk about, like professional workers talk about the right to disconnect from their iPhones because of the creeping hours, when they talk about workers who are computer programmers who feel like you got to show, like put in the hours and get the perks, but the perks are basically organized to get there early, to get you to this day late, and if you want to be taken seriously, you have to be a team player, you put the hours, and that is so deeply embedded in our culture, too. So what the A&I Women campaign is really challenging all that, challenging the labor movement to redirect itself towards this common fight that has the potential to bring many different kinds of work in all kinds of industries together around political demand, not an economic demand.
When the fight first started, the demands were economic. They wanted the wages that they were owed, the back pay.
Right.
But, you know, as we spoke about before, the enforcement of those judgments, which is why the sweat bill was so important, a judge can rule in your favor. But while
say
you're
a little
waiting
bit more
that,
about the sweat bill also, because I don't think we've really said what that is.
Sweat bill is a very basic bill that says that if you decide to take your employer to court for stolen wages, you are allowed to place a lien on their private property without them being aware of it for a set amount of time, so that it limits your employer's ability to transfer money out of their accounts, which usually happens. We've worked with a lot of people who win judgments and then they're awarded settlements, but then there's no money in their employer's accounts and their employers declare bankruptcy because they've funneled their money through relatives or something like that. So you get a judgment from a judge, but you get no money in the end.
Ken referenced earlier also, but
right.
So talk about the progress and what happened with that anti-sweat bill and the role that Cuomo is playing in all of this.
It had widespread support and was approved in both the Senate and Assembly in New York State, and then Cuomo vetoed it on the last day of the year. And he basically said it was un-American. You know, in America, we can't place liens on people's properties, but I'm pretty sure if I didn't pay my bill, my creditors would place liens on my properties. Like, I thought that was very American, actually. I don't know why it works when you have a mortgage and the bank decides to put a lien on your house if you stop payment, what the difference between that is and an employee not getting paid by their boss and wanting to do the same.
It's all designed to prevent employees from their assets. Avoid the money judgments that workers get when they do go to court and get these wage judgments. Like, so when workers like do everything to use the legal system to get what's the wages that are owed to them, employers like are able to exploit the legal system to move their assets to avoid the court judgments against them. So that's what the sweat was designed to do, is to like stop that process of them being able to move their assets, so that when they do get a judgment from a court, they'll be able to be paid the wages that they were robbed of, that they weren't paid.
Right. You know, in a woman scenario, like, there were workers who a judge sided in their favor, but then they won a judgment in their favor, but then, like, Cuomo directed one of his courts to put an emergency, what's the word?
Regulation. Are you talking about the home care workers?
Yeah. Yeah, they wouldn't allow the workers to collect the wages that they were told they were going to be paid because they were like, if you do this, you'll open Pandora's box and you'll bankrupt the healthcare system in New York State. And basically they're saying the system will collapse if we have to pay everyone for every hour they work and pay people what they're owed. But why should the system be maintained on the backs of women workers? You know, they're basically saying you won't have any job if you take this route. So you might as well just suck it up because at least you have a job, but you're going to destroy the healthcare industry. And if you do that, then there are no jobs for anyone. But that's placing the onus on like the most exploited worker. Why is it their responsibility to keep this system of exploitation going?
If we could take it to where we are now, what are the demands? What are the issues? What needs to be done to make sure that work is progressing to do away with this absolutely onerous condition?
There's legislation that the anti-women campaign that it would prohibit, places a ban, prohibit employers, home care employers, to impose, require workers to work 24-hour shifts, and that if 24-hour care is required, that it be done in split shifts of 12. So it's really to protect against the mandatory 24-hour bill. That is something that the anti-women campaign and a coalition of other groups are working on to get introduced into the state and Senate assemblies. People believe that is also a way to educate, you know, other workers about the whole issue of the 24-hour workday, but also more broadly the issue of control over time, something that people can also look to and get involved in.
In terms of just getting the bill passed, we have a lot of support and a lot of great co-sponsors. However, we need more co-sponsors. People should call their elected officials, talk to them about why the issue is important to them, why their state legislative should vote yes. But also, we talk about this Democratic supermajority that we have going on now, which override a Cuomo veto. And Cuomo is in a very vulnerable position right now. Everyone is seeing how he governs, the ramifications of his abuses of power and bullying. So we're hoping that we can get widespread support for this and sort of understand how the governor has played a hand, and that people see this bill within the larger fight as well.
Margaret, also, it seemed like this would be an opportune time to increase the penalties on employers in other realms, and also to perhaps revive the No Sweat Bill. If people do want to get involved, how can they contact the 8-Hour Women Campaign and the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops?
Find us on our website, 8iwoman.org. But you can find us on Twitter. We have Twitter accounts, and you can DM us. You can also just contact Jessica Ramos, who is the chair of the Labor Committee. She's taken on the sweat bill as one of her bills.
Great.
Yeah, and she's such a strong voice in Albany.
Well, miles to go before we sleep, but certainly with folks like you in the labor movement and in the CUNY Law School, we've got some way of moving forward. And I want to thank Shirley Lung from the CUNY Law School and also Margaret Lee from Ain't I a Woman. And let's keep on fighting.
This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people. For another world is possible.